Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What can Shakespeare tell us about our current state of politics? It might not seem like tales of plotting princes or star-crossed lovers or ancient Roman leaders have any direct relevance to American polarization and unrest in 2020. But Shakespeare scholar and Columbia professor James Shapiro argues in his book that the Bard's plays and how they've been interpreted throughout history reveal a great deal about American attitudes and political views throughout history. His book, titled Shakespeare in a Divided America, What His Plays Tell Us About Our Past and Future, takes the reader through hundreds of years of American history. Professor Shapiro guides us through President John Quincy Adams' racist views about Othello, explains why female Romeos became very popular during the 19th century, and demonstrates how the edits made in the 1998 film Shakespeare in Love revealed anxiety about homosexuality. Each story looks at the ways that Shakespeare's works held up a mirror to Americans, reflecting back our own cultural concerns, prejudices, and beliefs. Okay, James, I have a bunch of speaking dates here for you. Are they on?
I'm ready.
Okay. James will be speaking at the theater for a new audience on Saturday, March 21st. And currently, it's already still up on the website, 92nd Street Y, on Monday, March 23rd. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
I'm happy to have you here in the studio, though, today.
Really happy to be here.
So why is the way Shakespeare is interpreted a good barometer for political moods of the country?
We read newspapers, we read history books, but there's always something right beneath the surface that we don't get, especially about the things that divide us. Nobody's going to come out and say, I'm a racist and I don't like a black man touching a white woman, especially an abolitionist like sixth president of the United States, John Quincy Adams. Except when he writes about Othello and concludes that Desdemona, for marrying a black guy who strangles her at the end, gets what she deserved, you begin to get a sense of what's always there. And it's not just people you would expect it from. Even somebody who fought slavery tooth and nail couldn't wrap his head around miscegenation.
And one of the things that was so interesting about that is it was revealed he was dinner partners with an actress, and she was sort of, she wrote in her diary what he said, but she omitted his name.
He's the sixth president of the United States, retired from the office in Congress, and he mansplains for an entire evening, worst dinner party in history, to the leading Shakespeare actor in the world, Fanny Kemble, what Othello's about. And he doesn't realize she's a writer too. And he was stung by that and retaliated by writing this essay. So it's a good example of, and what you learn when people reveal what they truly think through Shakespeare. And what saddened me in reading about Adams, who I admire greatly, is he used the N-word according to Kemble. And that too is something that we don't ordinarily hear or know from our leaders.
You open the introduction to your book this way. Read by almost everyone at school, staged in theaters across the land, and long valued by conservatives as highly as by liberals, Shakespeare's plays remain common ground, one of the few places where Americans can meet and air their disparate views. So why has Shakespeare historically appealed to both the right and the left?
There's been a tug of war in this country for 200 years, whatever the issue is, whether it's immigration, whether it's race, whether it's the role of women in the workplace. And again, we're not really good at talking about that, mm-hmm. but we do it obliquely through Shakespeare. You go to see Kiss Me, Kate, you're watching the struggles of women after World War II.
I admit, that's the first one I looked up in the Taming of the Shrew. I looked up in the,
I mean,
in the index.
It's a toxic play. It's an incredibly interesting musical. And then a movie afterwards that, in the McCarthy era, rolls back all the progressivism of that great musical. So you can actually measure advances and retreats in attitudes towards the things that we care about most, but we talk about with each other least.
Which is also interesting because I think it was two summers ago, there was an all-female version of Taming of the Shrew.
In the park.
And it had a whole different vibe.
It was completely brilliant. But again, it's a toxic play and really
they turned it on
hard.
Its head a little bit, though, at the end.
I love that production.
It was really fun. Janet McTeer, she was so good.
She was amazing.
So do we know Shakespeare's own political views at all?
We don't, happily. And that's why the left, as well as the right, believe he's on their side. And that's the beauty of Shakespeare. The right, while trying to keep out immigrants a century or so ago in this country, Well, sure, that Shakespeare was an Anglo-Saxon, that America is an Anglo-Saxon nation, and use Shakespeare as a stick to beat all those, in this case, white, mm-hmm. but Jewish or Italian immigrants pouring into this country. And we had to re-educate them or keep them out. And Shakespeare was that buffer, was that wall.
By the way, my guest is James Shapiro. The name of his book is Shakespeare in a Divided America, What His Plays Tell Us About Our Past and Our Future. There are 8 sections, correct?
8, indeed.
Can you tell me how you decided on the 8 sections?
I thought about what are the things that tear us apart. Race, immigration, same-sex love, mm-hmm. class warfare, right now the sharp divisions between right and left. And I found a Shakespeare production or adaptation or film or musical that captured the tensions at a particular historical moment. 1849, Astor Place riots not mm-hmm. far from here, where the militia opened fire on New Yorkers. 10 to 24,000 had gathered around a new theater, the Astor Place Theater, where rich people decided not so rich people couldn't get in. And mm-hmm. it turns out New Yorkers weren't happy about that, started throwing cobblestones, trying to trash the place, and people died over Shakespeare. So we take Shakespeare seriously, maybe not in fifth grade, but certainly as a culture.
When did Americans first start to embrace Shakespeare?
We broke with England in 1776, mm-hmm. and Lin-Manuel Miranda reminds us of that as well as anyone, and yet we embrace their national poet as our own. And he was part of the early theatrical culture in this country, and he was also in the books that people learned from. So Abraham Lincoln, not hardly educated at all, no formal education, had a stepmom who brought in a book to their log cabin that had 32 selections of Shakespeare, and he memorized them, and he would quote from them till the week he died.
How does Shakespeare's work allow Americans? I mean, we talk about America and we talk about America's greatest sins that people sometimes still don't want to have conversations about. How does Shakespeare's work allow us to grapple with the sins of our history?
They allow us to do it both on the page and on the stage. Joe Papp of blessed memory changed our culture when at the Public Theater in the 1960s and 70s at the Delacorte, he started making his theater companies colorblind. And a lot of the great stars of that stage went on to normalize blacks and Hispanics and Latinx actors as superstars in this country. So there are subtle ways in which Shakespeare can change things. And sometimes he can't change things. When Oscar Eustace staged Julius Caesar 2 years ago in the park, it was explosive.
Now, you worked as a consultant.
I'm the Shakespeare scholar in residence mm-hmm. at the Public Theater, which means I help out the first week or so. Then I don't have to stand in line with you and everybody else. I get to go and see the play every night. And I watched the right-wing, alt-right reaction to that production as alt-right people, the Pizzagate folk, decided to offer $1,000 to anybody who would bust up that production and stop it cold.
Let's remind people that the actor playing Julius Caesar looked very much like Donald Trump.
He was a Trump lookalike, and Oscar Eustace was brilliantly exploring the largely liberal audience's mm-hmm. response to what does it feel like in a modern dress production when you see a Trump-like figure assassinated? How does it make you feel about the challenge to democracy and what you're destroying in the very act of trying to remove somebody like this man in this way? It was brilliant, and seating the audience with 50 fake protesters who heckled Brutus and the conspirators was brilliant. What he didn't understand is the right no longer wants to engage and argue. They want to issue death threats. They want to threaten. And that was my big takeaway. Now, this doesn't sound so dramatic, but this was not long after Trump was elected, where people were thinking, everything's going to be okay. We'll drift to the middle.
Right. There's about six months after.
Right.
About 6 months after. Yeah.
And that production really pointed the way in which we're going in ways that pundits had not anticipated.
My guest is James Shapiro. The name of his book is Shakespeare in a Divided America. Let's talk about women playing Romeo. What does this reveal about our attitudes about gender, that at one time women were playing Romeo?
1845 was the year Manifest Destiny was, you know, that phrase was created. Mm-hmm. And what that is really is an aggressive manliness that had no room for softer qualities in it. And that phrase was used to justify clearing out everything, Native Americans, the British from the Northwest, and we were going to invade Mexico, maybe head down to Central America. This was ours. We were once a sober republic, now we were an empire, and we were going to grab it. And it turned out at that time, you can use Shakespeare as a register of the problem with the shifting notion of masculinity. No longer founding fathers, sober, hardworking. Now it was, in a word, Trumpian, or then Andrew Jacksonian. And at the time, no male actor could carry off Romeo, who has to be, as he's called in the play, effeminate, but also has to pick up a sword and kill Tybalt. The only person who could really do it brilliantly was Charlotte Cushman. Yeah. And she was superstar of the age, lesbian, tough, better at both the effeminate and the masculine parts of the play. And Shakespeare tells you in ways that a society never can quite grapple with, what's the problem with being a man at any given moment?
What kind of anxieties did she inspire?
There was a great moment when she was playing, I think it was up in Boston, and some man snorted during the balcony scene where she kissed the actress playing Juliet. She stopped, she walked forward, she called him out. If no guy is going to take out this guy, I will do it myself. The audience cheered, the guy snuck out. She went and got her Juliet back again. A woman like that, you know, the term lesbian is not invented until the 1890s. We didn't even have a language to describe the anxieties she provoked. So again, Shakespeare on stage especially allows us to see what's really hard to put into words.
You also write a bit about how we can each interpret Shakespeare so very differently. And the one of the examples you use is President Lincoln and his assassin, John Wilkes Booth. Both loved Shakespeare.
They loved a different Shakespeare. John Wilkes Booth's a white nationalist, and he decides, I'm going to read Julius Caesar, I'm going to be the American Brutus, I'm going to kill this man, and after I kill him, I'm going to leap onto the stage and say, sic semper tyrannis, thus always with tyrants. And they were both enthralled with Macbeth. But John Wilkes Booth Macbeth was an unreflective man of action. President Lincoln, who read Shakespeare better than any American scholar or not ever, and felt his plays, understood the torment that a melancholy Macbeth felt. And he read Macbeth aloud to anyone who would listen for hours. And his Macbeth was a man who understands guilt. And of course, they collided on that fateful day in 1865. And the nation turned to Shakespeare and to Macbeth, commemorating Lincoln as Duncan and kind of sidestepping the whole problem of Reconstruction and slavery and Lincoln's legacy. So Shakespeare, as I try to write about, figures in many ways as a nation grapples with the crises it faces.
I was showing you when I came in, I brought my complete works of Shakespeare, and out fell my my assignment from English 126. Final examination will be held on Wednesday morning, 9 a.m., May 14th in Wilson 101.
I'm going to raise the grade on that response because of the great work you do.
Yeah, and one of the essay questions was about The Tempest. And so it was so interesting to hear you, to read you, writing about The Tempest. It's the play you used to talk about immigration in 1916, and you observe that you wrote, quote, community in Shakespeare's comedies depend much like immigration policy on who is barred admission as much as who is accepted.
Yeah.
What are some examples, well, and then how does that relate to The Tempest?
Sure.
And then I'll write it down for
Shakespeare's comedy. We love Shakespeare's comedies. We feel good at the end of those comedies, and we tend to forget that community at the end of those plays always keeps somebody out. Everybody's happy at the end of The Merchant of Venice. Shylock is outside that wall. Everybody is in love and resolved at the end of Twelfth Night. Malvolio was banished. Everybody goes back to Italy at the end of The Tempest. Caliban is left alone on the island. So the story of the comedies is a template for exclusion. It's not pretty to say, but it's the truth. And in 1916, there was a large scale. We're talking tens of thousands of participants and audience members up at City College. They wanted to do it in Central Park, but it would have destroyed the grass. Mm-hmm. So they did it up there, and they had a play called Caliban by the Yellow Sands. And it had as its villain Caliban, this figure who stood in for all the unwashed immigrants pouring into America. And it was actually intended as progressive, but it ended up being regressive because Caliban's always this threatened rapist. I mean, it really sounds like Stephen Miller's vision of The Tempest. And it's scary. And I track that and track the immigration battles, which led to, in 1924, the decision to have race-based immigration standards, which threatened to return again in this country. So these stories in Shakespeare and in our culture keep recurring, and Shakespeare acts as a kind of signpost, or to me, a canary in the coal mine, when we need to understand where we're heading and the newspapers can't quite point us in that direction.
My guest is James Shapiro. The name of the book is Shakespeare in a Divided America, What His Plays Tell Us About Our Past and Our Future. And what we do with his plays tell us quite a bit. You dedicate a chapter to the movie Shakespeare in Love, which won an Oscar for Best Picture in 1999. But there was the ending of it. And one version of it, Hollywood didn't really care for it. And it really showed a really interesting moment in how we think about homosexuality.
I looked at the earliest script of this. Mark Norman wrote it, and it turned out to be a story about a guy, Shakespeare, who falls in love with another man, even though he had thought of himself as heterosexual. And it's a brilliant script. But Harvey Weinstein, the producer, brought in Tom Stoppard, the brilliant British playwright, and Stoppard got rid of the gay theme. But he still couldn't figure out, how do you end a movie in which a man like Shakespeare, who's married, falls in love with a woman who's about to be married to another guy and they're having an adulterous relationship? How do Americans accept that? Because Americans, if you look at the stats, hate adultery more than anything else, even people who are committing adultery in this country. And it's a funny, sad, tormenting story that leads to 13 Academy Awards. To the very end, Harvey Weinstein, who's now happily behind bars, was trying to force the director and the screenwriter to turn this into the Harvey Weinstein story. The ending is simple. Just kind of throw her roles in exchange for sex, and that's a happy ending. So you can actually track in certain ways what is underneath the surface. And we're celebrating that film, and we don't really understand the forces that are operating all around us. Shakespeare helps us feel and see them.
If people want to read a piece of Shakespeare, a work of Shakespeare, for what's going on right now, what do you think's a good play?
Boy, I'll tell you. You know, Shakespeare lived through some pretty terrible pestilence and plague, and saw a seventh of his fellow Londoners die in 1592 and 3, and then again in 1603. My choice of play would be the play he's writing and alludes to people just dropping surprisingly dead from the plague in Macbeth. It's a dark play. We're living through a dark moment. I don't know if it's going to give us the same consolation that it gave Lincoln, but it's a good place to start.
The name of the book is Shakespeare in a Divided America, What His Plays Tell Us About Our Past and Our Future. Fellow English and American literature majors, you will love this book. James, thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Be safe, be well.
You too.